drought is impacting water levels and quality across the state. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Friday, August 6th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we explore the Big Sioux River in eastern South Dakota. We'll talk about water levels, debris exposed by the drought, and decision-making regarding water restrictions for cities such as Sioux Falls. Jacqueline Severin reports on efforts to boost South Dakota student reading levels. We take a moment for poetry from Studio 47 with Patrick Hicks. Plus, poet and scholar Norma Wilson is honored at the Dakota Conference this year. We'll talk with a poet whose latest collection is called Continuity. That's later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
For SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson. A South Dakota National Guard unit will begin a one-year deployment to Guantanamo Bay in January 2022. About 115 soldiers from the 235th Military Police Company will provide detention operations at the U.S. military's camp in Cuba. SDPB's Ariel Zions has more.
The South Dakota National Guard is deploying to Guantanamo Bay for the first time since the detention camp opened in 2002. Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Dice is a spokesman with the National Guard. He says the military police company is prepared for Guantanamo.
The unit is capable of detainee or internment operations, internal, external security for facilities.
President Joe Biden is hoping to close Guantanamo Bay, which has been criticized for torture, indefinite detentions, and jailing innocent people. 27 detainees aren't charged with any crime. The 12 others are charged or have been convicted in special military trials. Dice said this is the military police's fourth federal deployment since 9/11. The unit deployed once to Fort Carson and twice to Afghanistan.
We're capable, ready, prepared to perform a variety of different missions. And we just see this is another example of the Department of Defense, U.S. Army, looking to the South Dakota National Guard to fill in these different roles and capabilities and mission sets that are needed in these different areas across the world.
The soldiers will train for several weeks at Fort Bliss in Texas before heading to Guantanamo. I'm SDPB's Ariel Zions.
The state climatologist says August weather patterns are decreasing the chances for South Dakotans to recover from the drought. Laura Edwards expects even less rain this month.
Average precipitation is about half an inch a week or so this time of year. We're kind of on the downhill slide, as our wettest time is usually in June and July. So climatologically speaking, our chances of really having a good recovery of drought are kind of slipping away slowly as we get through August.
The U.S. Drought Monitor updates every Thursday at droughtmonitor.unl.edu. Farmers and ranchers create stock dams to hold water in dry areas. Salt from the soil washes into the dams during wet periods. The water evaporates during drought and the salt is left behind. That can be toxic for livestock and wildlife. Patrick Kozak is a PhD student at South Dakota Mines in Rapid City who is studying stock dams. He says salinity is measured in microsiemens per centimeter. Water becomes lethal at the 15,000 level.
We found in 2019, none of them were over 4,000. This year, we had 6% over 15,000. And as we've gone out every month, we've seen an increase in those as those impoundments, there's no freshwater recharge to dilute, so they keep concentrating.
Kozak says some stock dams are completely dried up.
As they recede down, you still have water in that pure shale, and it becomes a very thick, quick clay almost. And small lambs and sheep will get in there, and they'll get mired. They'll go down to their chest and not be able to get out. I have had that experience personally and gone down past my knee while I'm walking out trying to take measurements, even though I'm being safe.
Kozak says some ranchers with dried up dams are bringing in water by truck. To access our stories, visit the news page on our website at sdpb.org/news. With South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Lori Walsh. According to the South Dakota Department of Health, during the past calendar week, there were 52 confirmed COVID cases reported per day. That's an increase of 68% from the previous week. As cases rise, large gatherings like the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally are going forward as planned, and students are headed back to state colleges and universities. Earlier in the week, we checked in with the mayor of Sturgis. Today, we welcome Mayor Kelsey Collier-Wise from Vermilion, where the University of South Dakota is. Mayor Collier-Wise, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
Tell me a little bit about current mitigation and policy, or in current mitigation policies in Vermilion. Do you have mask mandates in place? Do you have what does it look like there?
So at this point, we really don't have anything specific. At the end of the year, we still had a sign requirement that had been in place all year that basically required all occupancies open to the public to post a sign that said that masks were expected. We required masks in city buildings and any sort of like city and public activities. As we saw the population really dwindle over the summer after the students left and our cases go way down and our vaccinations start to pick up, we allowed many of those emergency measures to expire. And I think the hope was that would be the end of it and we wouldn't be revisiting this again. But obviously, those discussions are happening again.
Yeah. So when do the students return to campus?
So some of the students are already here. The law school started this week. The PA school, I believe, started a couple of weeks ago, but the regular classroom students, the undergraduates and graduate students, will be coming here in a couple of weeks.
And how much does that change your population?
Well, that's always a tricky question in a college town because some people do stay here all summer, but, we anticipate, probably 5,000 to 7,000 new people coming in the matter of a weekend.
So let's talk a little bit about the information that you're getting from the State Department of Health. They've changed their policy to providing updates once a week, and this is a fast-moving virus. Do you feel like you're getting information from the State Department of Health that helps you make the decisions that you need to make and have the conversations that you need to have in a city like Vermilion?
Personally, I don't believe that once a week is often enough. The day that the CDC changed their recommendations as far as masking inside, one of the things that they said was that they wanted to see vaccinated people masking inside places that had high rates of spread. Well, if you went on the internet and checked the Department of Health, they would say that there was almost no spread in Clay County. But if you went to the CDC, it said that there was high spread. And that kind of confusion and difference in reporting makes it really hard to have the frank conversations that we need to be having because somebody will say, well, why does this say this? And maybe they're extrapolating we really need full information to be able to make these important decisions and for people to be able to make important individual decisions. I personally have an 11-year-old daughter who can't be vaccinated. And so my decisions about where she goes and what she does, I need that information. And so that has been a real frustration.
Do you have any indication from the State Department of Health that that is going to change? Have you talked to them or put in a request? How does that line of communication work?
To be perfectly honest, Lori, I have probably about as much information as you do. I check on the website.
What do you anticipate then in the days ahead as we look at what we know about large gatherings and the return? Students are not required to be vaccinated, correct? At the University of South Dakota, there's no vaccine requirement, is there?
That's correct, and I believe that that's a policy that comes down from the Board of Regents, not just USD specifically. So, no, they are not required to be vaccinated. I know that there is going to be a big push as they come onto campus, and we're looking at ways that we can help with that and participate in trying to encourage students to get vaccinated. Right now, Clay County only has about a 53% vaccination rate, and our 65 and up folks are 99% vaccinated. So that's a real relief, right, that those vulnerable people are. But now we're looking at just the chaos that outbreaks cause as far as canceled classes and missed work and people having to stay home with sick kids. without large-scale vaccination, I just don't know how we avoid, you know, another year of real uncertainty and chaos.
Kelsey Collier-Wise is mayor of the city of Vermilion. Mayor Collier-Wise, thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks so much, Lori.
Up next, Jacqueline Severin searches for solutions to raising the reading proficiency of South Dakota kids. You're in the moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
This week on Science Friday, answering questions about COVID, like should school kids get vaccinated?
Vaccination is certainly part of that for kids 12 and up, but we need to continue layering all of the other things that work.
And a CRISPR victory against disease.
CRISPR is the equivalent of flying to the stars if we were astronomers.
All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain.
Program funding by Art South Dakota, a catalyst for creative and artistic expression in communities and schools throughout South Dakota. Advancing the arts through education, service, and advocacy. More at artsouthdakota.org.
SDPB's Fiddles and Friends returns this August with three live concerts. Enjoy music from talented fiddlers including Kenny Putnam, Tom Schaefer, and Owen DeYoung. Join us in Watertown on August 26th. Sioux Falls on August 27th or on August 28th in Rapid City. Help support SDPB and get your tickets today by going to sdpb.org/fiddles. Sponsored by Chris Bro Hospitality and First Bank and Trust.
Coffee, your alarm, another Monday morning. These things are a given. Getting news you can trust should be too. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this member station by name.
Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. 64% of South Dakota fourth graders are not proficient in reading. That's according to the latest National Kids Count report. It ranks states on how well children are doing on a number of important metrics. Jacqueline Severin looks at two organizations striving to improve child reading rates. She has this story for SDPB.
The number of kids who cannot read at grade level is dropping. Zanna Berg is the Kids Count coordinator for South Dakota.
So they're at 64% now. A decade ago was at 67. So that's, you know, trending in the right direction. And South Dakota does do better than the national average. So, you know, 64 in South Dakota versus 66 nationally.
But that's still about two-thirds of kids who can't read proficiently. The data comes from a national study published every year by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. This year's data is from 2019, so it does not include any impacts the pandemic may have had on reading levels. Fourth grade reading proficiency data comes from standardized tests. Berg says it's not a perfect measure, since some kids don't test well. But the data does show demographic information that explains who's being left behind.
We could be doing better as a state to support educational opportunities for all children, but also specifically for lower-income families and children of color.
The data shows that 79% of African-American fourth graders are not proficient in reading. For Latinos, the number is 80% and 86% for American Indian students. One program focused on improving reading skills is the Black Hills Reads campaign. It's part of the United Way. Kayla Klein directs it and says they partner with other groups to provide access to books and reading materials. They work with the Dolly Parton Imagination Library and the One Book Program. One Book gives a book to second graders across the state and then brings the author or illustrator into the classroom. Klein says because of the pandemic, they are using more web-based options to connect with more teachers and parents. They now have a weekly email newsletter that provides resources for early learning education. Klein says their main goal is to help children reach reading proficiency by third grade.
From birth to grade three, children are learning to read. And from third grade on, they're reading to learn.
Klein says it's important to start building basic reading skills at an early age.
And if you can't create this strong foundation, there is struggle after struggle from that point on. It is so, so difficult for children to catch back up if they have not made those important connections in those first few years of their lives from 0 to age 8.
Of all the programming Black Hills Reads provides, Klein says their most important work is advocating for early childhood education.
We understand that this is a state that isn't all about things being mandatory. But if a parent wants an early childhood early education for their child, they should be able to access it, and it should not cost them college tuition rates to get that education for their child.
On the other side of the state in Sioux Falls, Reach Literacy works to improve reading levels in kids and adults. The nonprofit runs a used bookstore to provide better access. Each family gets 5 free children's books per visit. A mother with 3 young boys and a baby comes into the store. The boys are immediately drawn to the books and start taking them off the shelves to read.
I found Ninja Turtles!
Awesome! Ninja Turtles!
You found a snake book?
Oh, that's kind of gross. That's cool.
Brianna Venekamp is the program coordinator at Reach. She says this is just the reaction they want from young readers. Unfortunately, she says as kids get older, reading becomes more of a chore, especially when they enter third grade.
They're becoming more self-aware. They're becoming more sensitive to the world around them and people's expectations and pressures. And so that motivation is so key. And I think we need to understand that more and be conscious of it.
Reach uses a summer reading challenge to encourage kids. They mark on a calendar how many days they will read each week. At the end of the month, they bring in their calendar to get a free book. This is the first year for their summer reading challenge. Venekamp says it's been a big success. They're seeing more kids in the bookstore as parents try to wean them from their electronic devices. Another Reach effort, called Be a Reader, pairs reading mentors with second graders. Venekamp says the program provides books and creates an experience around reading. She says it's important to give young readers support when they need it.
So if you're stuck, you need someone that helps you, that doesn't, you know, criticize you for not being able to do it at a young age.
Venekamp says it really helps when children have a choice about what they read. She says adults often try to steer kids towards certain types of books. But to foster a love of reading, kids need to find books they can connect with.
If someone likes baseball and they only want to read baseball books, like, that's okay. Like, they're reading, you know? Or if they like graphic novels, okay, keep reading graphic novels.
Venekamp says if kids enjoy reading, a book will compete more successfully against electronic devices. She says even when they read for fun, they are gaining skills that will help them for a lifetime. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jacqueline Severn in Sioux Falls.
This is Terrace Stewart.
This
one.
You can find and share this story online at sdpb.org/news. Ahead on the program, Drought in Our Rivers and Streams. We talk with friends of the Big Sioux River after a break. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
People could work from home, but managers could also have a bias against them.
There is a real risk that people with diverse backgrounds and identities will be left behind.
I'm Amy Scott. Remote work and favoritism, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding with your support and by Ingalls Homestead, Laura's Living Prairie, sharing Laura Ingalls Wilder's pioneer heritage through covered wagon rides and hands-on activities. Online at IngallsHomestead.com.
Business and nonprofits that support SDPB demonstrate that they care about honest reporting, education, and the arts. Corporate partners sponsor this trusted content, and they reach people who are responsible for shaping our communities. Every day, inquisitive kids and lifelong learners across South Dakota trust SDPB to provide high-quality information and entertainment, and they trust the corporate partners that make it possible. Become a sponsor of SDPB TV, radio, and digital.
The exploration of cutting-edge products and services being offered in South Dakota is highlighted on our Science and Technology Beat, supported on SDPB by Black Hills Information Security. Science and Technology Reporting is supported by Black Hills Information Security.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. As much of South Dakota strains under drought conditions, today we explore the impact of drought on rivers and streams. Travis Entman is Managing Director of the Friends of the Big Sioux River. Jay Gilbertson is Manager of the East Dakota Water Development District. And they're joining me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. It's just a stone's throw away from the falls of the Big Sioux River, if you've got a pretty good arm.
It is, yeah.
Travis and Jay, thanks for being here. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having us.
Appreciate the invite.
Let's talk about just visually when you walk by the Big Sioux River. If you live in the city of Sioux Falls, you can see a big difference in the water flow, the quantity of it. You can see things coming up from, you know, pollution and old tires and sort of how much is this drought affecting the water levels of the river? Who wants to sort of kick that off? Jay?
Laura, I'll start that. We pulled up some records. The state and the federal government and a number of agencies monitor water levels in the river for a lot of different reasons. And over the last several months, the very clearly low water levels that everyone can notice, we're running probably an order of magnitude, 10% of what normal might be. And for a lot of folks, this really stands out because just a year or two ago, we were that same degree above normal. We were running really full, and now we're running really empty. And so, if nothing else, there's a lot less water. So the things that are in the river, like the tires and the shopping carts and the old TVs, are now visible. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, they were underwater.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Just 2 years ago, I mean, it was blocked off. You couldn't go. Maybe 2 or 3 years ago. Now I've got my times mixed up a little bit because the pandemic just like froze the progression of time in my mind. You couldn't even access Falls Park, for example, when you came to work in the morning. Travis, just a very basic question. Can you pick up that stuff when you see it? Are there plans to, when you talk about river cleanup, are there opportunities for taking care of some of that pollution when it becomes visible?
Yeah. So with Friends of Big Sioux River, we've been doing a lot of these river cleanup events along the river here in Sioux Falls, but up in Flandreau and Watertown. And concerned citizens, other like-minded groups are more than welcome to have events like that. We've done 5 this year at about 6-7 different locations. And each time, it's a pretty easy process. You contact city officials. So mm-hmm. we talk to the Parks Department here in Sioux Falls, say, hey, we're looking at doing a cleanup on this park along the river. This is when, where, and how many people we expect to have. And they're like, cool, we're happy to help. So it's been a real nice working relationship like that. And then at the end of the events, the Parks Department will come up and collect the bags of trash that we put together. So it's anyone can, go out there and pick up trash. There's groups like ours that have events or even can help spearhead an event. It might not be ours, but if you're interested in having a community event or even a family reunion and don't know how to get started with it, Friends of the Big Sioux River, organizations like that can help figure that out.
So I lost my car keys years ago on the river, and I just wait. My library card was attached. I just wait that someday, some year, someone's going to return them to me. Are people just dumping stuff? And when you look at that, there is a bit of a shock when you see the plastic bags. And you see, are people like actively throwing stuff in the river? Do we still pollute river intentionally?
It's hard to tell. Yes, people have thrown things just directly in the river, but given the recent flooding we've had, mm-hmm. a lot of that stuff got pulled in from people's yards. This past June, we did a cleanup in front of the farmer's market here in Sioux Falls.
Sure.
across from Smithfield there. And because the water level was so low, we got six bikes out of there, a TV from the 80s, you know, bunch of old signs. All of that was dumped there a while ago. So, you know, it's kind of hard to know when this trash gets there, depending on water levels. But we usually see, you know, pop cans, beer cans, plastic bags, you know, utensils, things like that, that kind of get blown in. Or if we have some rain like we did yesterday, sometimes that just gets kind of flown in. But that big stuff has usually been there for a while.
And, you know, you look at the history of the Big Sioux River and how it flowed clean and had multiple, you know, different kinds of species in it. The ecosystem has changed. That that can be kind of disheartening a little bit.
Well,
Jay, go ahead.
Yeah. certainly, you know, if we could go back to the way things were 150 years ago, the river would look quite different. A good friend of mine was asked several years ago, you know, what would it take to turn the river back the way it was?
Sure.
And the answer, well, simple. Everybody has to leave. I mean, development and the impacts of that are something that are part and parcel with our being here. We can certainly do a better job. Some of it is, you know, we didn't understand initially that, you know, just because the waste went away, that it didn't really go away. It just left our space.
It moves downstream.
Yeah.
It goes somewhere else. And so we need to get better at that.
Right.
But part of it is simply recognizing that if we want to live along the river and interact with the river, we're going to have to do a better job. It cannot take everything that we put into it.
It's choices that we're making.
Yeah.
We're making choices for better or for worse. There's an impact based on our choices. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that when we talk about extremes and the growth of the city of Sioux Falls, new industry coming in, where our drinking water comes from. How do people think about the river other than a place to, you know, which the city of Sioux Falls, in my opinion, does a great job of sort of highlighting with the bike trails and the park system. You're often invited to the river, but there's a lot more happening. Talk a little bit about where water comes from and how it's impacted by a growing Sioux Falls.
This is Jay. I mean, the Big Sioux River, which is one of the sources that the city draws water from, they have an intake on the north side of the airport, starts up near Summit. The north end of up in northeastern South Dakota and flows down along the eastern side, picking up, you know, tributaries and whatever else comes along. And with that, anything that can get into the river along that path is going to be part of it when it gets here. Mm-hmm. We'd certainly like to keep that as clean as possible. But for the city, in terms of drinking, that's just one source. The city also draws water from shallow aquifers that are adjacent to the river and that some kind can exchange water, and currently also pulls water in from Vermilion, courtesy of the Lewis and Clark Regional Water System Pipeline. And so they have several different choices.
So when new industry comes in, a new packing plant, an Amazon factory, when things grow, when the city expands, more people need more water.
Right. Yep. And so when new industry comes in, you know, depending on the type of industry, they're looking at getting water use permits. So how much water can we use in this facility? And if they have wastewater byproduct, are we going to discharge directly into the river or one of its tributaries? How does that work? So that's stuff that you have to think about as we expand and grow. Who's using that water? And to your point about where is that water coming from? You know, right now, we're seeing pollution levels slightly different from previous years, just because of the low flows. But you know, we have discharge permits and discharge pipes going into the river from different industries. The city of Sioux Falls discharges, you know, treated wastewater. But we're also seeing non-point source pollution, which is all that stuff on land that gets washed in. After rain events or snow melt and stuff like that. So that, all that water is coming in and all those accumulate to impact the river and to, really affects how we move forward on who uses water and who gets to pollute the river.
Because you had a partnership with Remedy Brewing where you took surface water and made beer. How much work was it to make that drinkable?
Right.
I mean, just from the sense of like pulling water out of the river and saying, and now we're going to use it, it has to be treated.
Right.
Tell me that story.
It's a pretty incredible process. So we only took out 300 gallons of surface water over by the 26th Street Bridge. And it took us a roughly 10 hours to make 120 gallons of clean water going through a reverse osmosis machine. So basically, it runs through a bunch of filters and reverse osmosis to make it cleaner than 10 times cleaner than tap water. It's as close to distilled water as you can get without being distilled water.
Sure.
So it's an intensive process, and this was on a very small scale. 300 gallons isn't that much. We actually just did it again. We're making another beer with Remedy for Riverfest coming up.
Sure.
Doing the same process, and we got it. Took a little. It was a little quicker. Only 8 hours this time, but it's a tedious process. And if you had a large volume of beer, that would take, you know, a long time.
A fun educational exercise,
right?
But also, it sounds expensive to me, Jay. It sounds like something that if you wanted to do it for more than, you know, a small batch of craft beer.
Exactly.
This is not what you want to be doing.
It was a lot. I was involved with the second process, yeah, we were able to get about a 50%. I think there we drew about 240 and got about 120 back. Yeah. The water was a little cleaner. Mm-hmm. We had a little better surface. And so the message there is, well, if the water is a lot cleaner, then even if we're running it through the RO units, it will take less time. We'll get less waste and so forth. So, again, it's a point of if the cleaner the river is, the easier it is to make beer,
right?
Or the easier it is. there's less work for clean drinking water. Right. I mean, the city has to treat the water. We do not drink just water straight out of the tap, or straight out of the river, or out of the ground. It all has to be treated. Mm-hmm. But obviously, the less stuff that is in it that needs to be taken out, the easier that process is going to be, and the less costly it's going to be.
Right.
Now, there are technologies available that can pretty much take anything out of the water. You know, there are places around the world that are using basically recycled wastewater for drinking water because that's what they have. That's all they have. We're not there yet, and we'd like to avoid that as long as possible.
When does it run out? In the last, 30 seconds or so that we have,
how long
do these resources last at our...
Yeah. If they're managed properly, the resources themselves won't run out. What will run out is our ability to expand. The Lewis and Clark pipeline I mentioned earlier was developed because we looked forward and said by sometime about a decade ago, it was projected that the available local groundwater and surface water would no longer be enough to support continued growth. The city wasn't going to run out of water, but the next guy that moved in would have to bring his own. And so a new source had to be identified. Mm-hmm. If we manage what we have soundly, we can keep them going, but if we want to continue to grow, we're going to have to identify some new sources as well.
Interesting. Travis Entman is Managing Director of the Friends at the Big Sioux River. Jay Gilbertson is Manager of the East Dakota Water Development District. A little water conversation to start your day. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for being here. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Let's take a moment now for poetry from Studio 47. Here's Patrick Hicks.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Sharon Shemilars. She was born and raised in Mobridge, South Dakota. After graduating from high school, she attended the University of Minnesota and made the Twin Cities her permanent home. Shemilars, however, frequently returns to her home state of South Dakota, and her work often orbits around the rural experience. When I asked her what got her into writing, she had this to say. I started writing in a fluky way. I was teaching German, and my job was on the line. Call it school district budget cuts. So after my workday, and in summers, I went back to the University of Minnesota to pick up a degree in English. One of the courses for the literature requirement was poetry. I absolutely fell in love with it, and that's how it started. Her books include Different Arrangements, The Rhubarb King, Little Eternities, Calling, The Widow's House, and Speaking in Riddles, among many others. She has been a finalist for the Independent Book Publishers Award, the Midwest Book Award, and the National Poetry Series. Her work has been translated into French as well as Polish. She continues to write in the Twin Cities. Today's poem is New Water. For anyone that has grown up on a farm, it's understood that a well needs to be dug for water. What is siphoned up from the earth might be hard or maybe too mineralized, and perhaps it needs to be softened. What I like about our poem for today is how water becomes a metaphor for love. This is New Water by Sharon Schmielars. All those years, almost 100, the farm had hard water, hard orange, buckets lined in orange, sink and tub and toilet too, once they got running water. And now, in less than a lifetime, just by changing the well's location, in the same yard, mind you, the water's soft, clear, delicious to drink. All those years to shake your head over. Look how sweet life has become. You can see it in the couple who live here, their calmness as they sit at their table, the beauty as they offer you new water to drink.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. This episode was recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
More poetry from Studio 47 is available online at ps47.org. Ahead on the program, the poetry of Native American people and new poetry from Norma Wilson. We welcome the poet after the break. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
This week on Science Friday, answering questions about COVID, like should school kids get vaccinated?
Vaccination is certainly part of that for kids 12 and up, but we need to continue layering all of the other things that work.
And a CRISPR victory against disease.
CRISPR is the equivalent of flying to the stars if we were astronomers.
All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, noon Mountain.
Program funding by Denny Menholt Toyota in Rapid City, inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menholt Toyota. See you at Denny Menholt Toyota in Rapid City.
In December, pianist Kevin Hayes and bassist Ben Street joined drummer Billy Hart for a live stream performance celebrating the master drummer's 80th birthday. Despite the musicians' concerns that their chops weren't in top shape because of the pandemic pause, the performance was such a success that it's been released on a new album. We'll sample it this evening on Jazz Nightly along with a previously unreleased 1975 session by entertainer Scatman Crothers. I'm Carl Gerke, and you can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Program funding by Mitco Business. We're in the business of helping partners go up and to the right. Head in the right direction with customized business internet, phone, and TV solutions to stay in touch and in control. More at midco.com/business.
Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The annual Dakota Conference at the Center for Western Studies is underway. Each year, an individual is recognized with the Dakota Conference Award for distinguished contribution to the preservation of the cultural heritage of the Great Plains. Norma Wilson is the honoree for 2020, and she is recognized for her work as a literary scholar, a poet, and particularly for her work in Native American poetry scholarship. Norma Wilson joins me inside SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lori. It's wonderful to be with you again.
It seems like the last time we were together, we were talking about the Great American Read, and I came to your house, and we sat and saw your writing space, and now here you are in my house, in the
yes.
radio studio. So thanks for returning the visit.
Oh, you're welcome.
Congratulations on this award, and it's presented at the 2021 conference, presumably because last year you were not able to accept the award in the context of an in-person conference. Do I understand that correctly?
That's right, because of COVID. It's good to be in person here.
Yeah.
Although we're still not over the pandemic, unfortunately, and hoping that everyone will get vaccinated and that we can have some immunity.
I wanted to talk because this is a book that you and I have never discussed, The Nature of Native American Poetry. This book features the work of M. Scott Momaday and Joy Harjo long before she became National Poet Laureate. Where did your interest in Native American poets and their influence begin?
My interest began in Oklahoma when I was studying for a PhD in English at the university there. Now, I had been educated in every field of British and American literature, but not in Native literature. Hmm. I came to realize that when I met so many Native Americans and heard so many Native American writers, including Momaday, there on campus. And I was president of the English Forum, so I was able to go to the student body and get money to bring in writers to campus. And so it was a lot of fun to hear them read, and I just became excited about the field of Native literature. It was not only that, I became excited about multicultural literature in the United States. Ethnic writing, it was being called. And interestingly enough, an anthology called Speaking for Ourselves, which was a forerunner in this, began with the work of Vine Deloria Jr., who was born here in South Dakota.
Yeah.
So when I completed my doctorate and was offered the position at the University of South Dakota teaching English with a specialization in Native literature, I was so excited because I so admired the Lakota people and still do. Of course, I wrote a dissertation on the spirit of place in Native American poetry. I guess I did that because I learned so much about my relationship to the American land from that, and my spiritual relationship, that I belong to the earth. I learned that, and that I needed to give back because everything we have comes from the land, and we need to take care of it.
Did you feel at some point that there had been a gap in your education when you discovered the work of some of these authors to say, why wasn't this integrated into the education I've already received on poetry and literature? Did you feel like there was room for, and is there still room for, more study, more historic scholarship on Native poetry, Native literature, Native expression?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And not just Native poetry and scholarship, although that should be basic. I mean, that should be first. But when I read in that anthology, Speaking for Ourselves, a poem by Langston Hughes that was published in 1938 entitled, Let America Be America Again, in which he says, it never was America to me. And yet, I swear this oath, America will be. I was so inspired by that, that people like Langston Hughes, people of color in our country, had not been able to be part of the American dream. And I wanted the dream to come true for everyone. So, you know, as I look back, and I realize that Native people don't really think that America is part of their dream, and it isn't. And we can learn from them about a basic relationship to the land before it was called America and colonized, because they have maintained their Native culture and language, or from those who have been able to do that and pass it on. But also we can learn from immigrants, like the people who are coming now and who have come in the past, either been forced to come as slaves or who came voluntarily, maybe as refugees or for other reasons, to be part of the American dream. People from Asia, people from across our border from the south, and really there was no border before. And if you think about that, Texas was part of Mexico, and, you know, it was all one America, and that's been the dream too. So there are many dreams that can come together, and they're not going to be able to thrive until we really relate to each other and listen. Listen to the other people speak, not just the Northern European cultures, but all the other cultures. And I found in reading Speaking for Ourselves, when I read white ethnic writing, like Italian-American writing, oh, they'd been discriminated against too, and they were writing about that, Irish. There was so much that these cultures had in common. Hmm. And Native Americans see that.
I wanted to ask you, as a follow-up, the role of poetry in having those voices heard. There are many options for expression.
Right.
What do you think poetry has to offer those multiple voices?
I think poetry has an emotional component to it. Hmm. It's like song. It expresses the deep, heartfelt desires and needs of people. It can speak more powerfully in some ways than other forms, such as, say, essays. It doesn't take long for that message to get across either. You don't have to read pages and pages. You may just have to hear a poem. Of course, for Native people, it was song that was their poetry. And it's beautiful.
And in your book, I find the thread of influence that these voices had on some of the poets that many of us study, the Transcendentalists, other poets who were connected, again, to this sense of place, but who were also connected to some people and inspired by that song, that poetry, that spoken word of their neighbors, their indigenous neighbors, which yes. I found fascinating.
The oral tradition. Mm-hmm. And hearing the chants and songs, yes. Hmm.
You have a new book as well, a new poetry collection. Tell me a little bit about that. I haven't seen it yet.
My book, Continuity?
Yes.
Well, I put that book together during the COVID crisis in 2020. And I wanted it to just be a product of how I was feeling at the time, I guess, of what was the course of my life. Maybe COVID, while we were staying at home and being so isolated, made us think more about our own individual lives and how they developed and what influenced us. And I thought about my grandparents. Hmm. And they lived on a farm, and they lived in a very close relationship to the natural world because they produced the food they ate. They had animals, hogs, cows, chickens. And my grandmother churned butter and made buttermilk and butter, and I sat in her lap while she did that, and she would sing to me, and my grandfather would milk the cow and asked me to sing to him as I was standing on the gate, and he would let me throw in the corn cobs mm-hmm. to the hogs. I just loved that way of life before electricity and before running water. And so those things influenced me. Would you like to hear a poem?
I would love to hear a poem.
From the book?
Yes, please.
Okay. Let me see if I can remember it. Summer nights on Tennessee Ridge. Grandmama and Granddaddy sing to the mockingbirds. They teach me whippoorwill's song. Looking up at the Big Dipper, like the one we dip in the pail to drink rain that falls from the sky. We count the stars that arc and fall above us. We call to the distant hoo of the owl and doze within the dark embrace of night.
That's poet and scholar Norma Wilson. You can see her at the Dakota Conference this weekend. Her latest book is called Continuity. We also spoke in this segment about her book, The Nature of Native American Poetry, published in 2001. South Dakota Public Broadcasting and Levitt at the Falls are partnering this summer to bring you the digital series Music Matters. Host Apollonia Davalos introduces artists and explores community as it intersects with musical expression. Sioux Falls vocalist Ashley Ballou Bonema uses singing as a way to battle cystic fibrosis. Through her Breathe Bravely organization, she helps others with cystic fibrosis sing too. Music Matters to Ashley Ballou Bonema.
Today, we breathe bravely and find our voice through vocalist and musician Ashley Ballou Bonema. Her values of courage, community, and connectedness teach us to inhale beauty through every breath. Music Matters is humbled to introduce Ashley Ballou Bonema.
The Sings by Our Virtual Choir is unique because it's made up of individuals from all over the world living with cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease that impacts the lungs and pancreas and multiple other organs. Our body creates too much mucus, therefore leading to complications that create devastating effects to our lungs, leading to respiratory failure, making each breath more and more difficult. Singspire is a program and a choir that empowers individuals with cystic fibrosis to not only find the beauty within every single breath, but to use it to share their voice. In the United States, affects 30,000 individuals and worldwide 70,000 individuals. And two people with cystic fibrosis are not supposed to share the same space. So we've all been living in this kind of COVID realm for the last, 16 months or so. And people with cystic fibrosis live that every day. Individuals with cystic fibrosis harbor bacteria within their lungs. That is not a problem to the general population, but if two people with cystic fibrosis share the same space, it's very similar to like spreading COVID. So the 6-foot rule that everybody has lived by for the last year or so is something that the CF community lives by every single day. And so I might be harboring a bug within my lungs that if I cough on my hand and I touch something, or I cough into the air, again, aerosolization, that somebody else with CF might have never been introduced to before, or their body's not able to handle that bacteria or virus or fungus. And so it can be deadly to them. For so many years, I hid the fact that I had cystic fibrosis. Because I'm a musician, I didn't want those paths to intersect. I didn't want my peers, my colleagues, to know that I couldn't breathe as well as them. So at the end of my graduate schooling, after many difficulties with cystic fibrosis and the fact that it was becoming more and more difficult for me to outrun, I took that stage for the last time for my graduate recital and knew in so many respects how my path had led to that very moment and just how singing had saved my own life. And that is Singspire, sharing the power of singing, the life-giving power of singing, with other individuals who may think it's impossible. We write all of our own music, and it has, a connection that is so much deeper that the greater world might not be able to, exactly put their finger on it and connect directly to it. But we try and write it in a way that the choir itself connects on a deeper level while still creating that connection and that empathy outside of that with our community. I think everybody in their life at some point has struggled to take that breath, has felt breathless, has felt defeated by their own body and their life's circumstances. So it's a way to connect our choir at a deeper level while still connecting to our greater community. One song that I always go back to in my own life that has had such profound meaning and will always have just a hold on my sense as a musician and
where I look ahead. And those days that I still question, what am I doing? And am I a musician? Am I good enough? Do I have a voice that's needed or worthy to be shared? And that is a folk song hymn that is called How Can I Keep From Singing? And in my darkest times, in the days that I questioned what I was doing and trying to live those separate lives of being a musician and being an individual with cystic fibrosis, I can tell you my life always came back to that simple song, that my life flows on in endless song. Above earth's lamentations, I hear the real though far off song that hails a new creation. And that still just gives me chills in my body, thinking that every single one of us, no matter what we're going through, no matter what life has given us, we all feel sadness, we all feel joy, we all feel pain, we all feel that excitement. We just call it something different. And if we just go back to the idea of the reverberations within our soul of how can we not be grateful, how can we not be joyful, how can we not live this best life, literally finding the beauty within every breath. How can we keep from singing?
We'll be bravely on this journey, never ceasing until it's won. We are strong enough together, fighting sea.
So very much for being with us today. I learned not only about cystic fibrosis, but about you as a person, as an artist that has inspired people around the whole globe. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find more Music Matters on our website, sdpb.org/music. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Special thanks today to SDPB's Crystal Schoenbauer and to Jacqueline Severin for their help with today's production. On the next In the Moment, the COVID pandemic urged many South Dakotans to rethink their wills and their estate plans. It might be a measure of respect to be named the executor of someone's will, but there's also an emotional toll. Financial therapist Rick Kaler joins us to unpack the turmoil. We'll also explore the history of so-called green books and the listings in South Dakota, what it was like to travel through a state with limited civil rights protections. For Chris Loffrey, Steve Zwemke, and Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.